It has been said many times that Donald Trump was not a cause of something ugly in American life, but a symptom. That is doubtless true, in as much as he could not have been elected president in the first place without a plurality of American voters seeing something in him that they liked. But on Wednesday, Donald Trump was indisputably the cause of something ugly in American history. As Congress gathered for what should have been the routine chore of certifying the vote of the Electoral College, Trump staged the latest of his self-pitying rallies and incited a mob to rush the Capitol building. In the ensuing affray, the seat of American democracy was trashed, four of the president's own supporters died, and a police officer was murdered. The crowd Trump launched at the Capitol was one of thousands, but it represented millions of Americans who now inhabit a parallel universe in which the 2020 election was stolen and their country is governed by the precepts of various absurd conspiracy theories. So where does the extremist paranoia stoked by Trump go after he leaves office? Where did Wednesday's events fall on the spectrum between riot by an unruly rabble spontaneously wound up by a spiteful, vindictive loser and serious premeditated attempt at a coup d'etat? What do we know about what and who was behind it? And more to the point, is this really likely to be the end of it? This is the Foreign Desk.
We're going to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I love Pennsylvania Avenue. And we're going to the Capitol.
Let's have trial by combat.
Up on the steps of the backside of the Capitol, we're seeing protesters overcome the police. The police are now running back into the Capitol building. We have cheers from the protesters that are watching behind the scenes. They broke the glass.
Everybody stay down. Get down.
Two buildings on Capitol Hill have now been evacuated or are in the process of being evacuated.
One person has been killed after being shot inside the Capitol, and improvised explosive devices have been found.
And welcome to this special live edition of The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Suzanne Lynch, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Irish Times, who witnessed Wednesday's events and has been following the story since. Suzanne, it is early Saturday morning in Washington, D.C. What is the city expecting to wake up to today?
Well, I mean, this is still a city very much in shock at what happened last Wednesday. Of course, people knew that there were going to be protests on Wednesday. It had been well flagged by Donald Trump, who'd encouraged his supporters to come here. And of course, Wednesday was a key day because Congress was meeting to certify the results of the election. But no one expected what happened to happen here on Wednesday. And now people are concerned about reports last night from Twitter when they banned Donald Trump from the social media platform, but they said that in fact they had found intelligence effectively about another kind of attack on January the 17th. That would have been a few days even before the inauguration. So it still is very much a city on edge here, and the mayor, Muriel Bowser, has extended a public emergency until January the 21st, and a lot of states have sent in extra backup forces that are going to be present here until for at least a few weeks.
The Twitter ban you allude to, which was announced last night and which is intended to be permanent, not merely temporary, does that change the political calculus surrounding what happens now to Donald Trump at all? There is some suggestion that articles of impeachment could be moved against him again, perhaps as early as Monday. But if there are now Republican senators who feel liberated from the threat of Trump, you know, unleashing his flying monkeys on Twitter, might there be the votes to actually remove him from office?
Well, I think what we can say is that I don't like making predictions, Andrew, but I think the Democratic-controlled House will move forward with impeachment next week. And Nancy Pelosi last night issued yet another statement really stating this. She's under a lot of pressure from people on the left in her party, people like Ilhan Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to do this straight away. And in fact, Pelosi herself is quite furious about what happened. She is the Speaker of the House, after all, and this building, Capitol Hill, was invaded effectively on Wednesday. So I can envisage a scenario where on Monday an article of impeachment is brought to the floor. And that process happened quite quickly. Now, the problem, of course, is that it's a two-pronged process. And even if the House was to impeach Donald Trump, it needs to go to the Senate for a trial. And as we know, almost exactly a year ago now, this scenario happened so that Donald Trump was impeached. But of course, he wasn't removed from office because there were insufficient Republicans to convict him in that impeachment trial when it went over to the Senate. Now, we're in the same situation, more or less, now. But really, you know, even if they don't have the Republican votes to remove him from office, it would still mean that Donald Trump would be impeached. You know, the Democrats do have the votes in the House to impeach him. So he would become the first president for the first time to be impeached twice. And I think at this stage, you know, the symbolism is important. The problem for Nancy Pelosi is if they let this go, you know, and you played the clip there at the beginning of Donald Trump calling for people to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue and get to the Capitol. If they let that go, well, then, you know, in 100 years time, historians will be looking at this saying, well, this president was able to get away with that without being impeached. You know, what is the bar anymore? So I think we're looking at an impeachment possibly next week. You're right about the Senate and the Republicans. In saying that, I think there are more Republicans who would vote to remove him than the last time. So last time we only had one, Mitt Romney, who voted to remove Donald Trump, but only on one of the two counts that were before them at that point. I think we are looking at definitely four or five, maybe at least, who would move to remove Donald Trump because the game has changed here. The other issue, of course, is that there are only a few days left in Donald Trump's presidency. So another possibility here, which is intriguing, is that the impeachment trial could happen in the new, you know, when under Biden when Donald Trump has left office. And there appears, Andrew, to be nothing stopping that happening. And the key here would be that this would also, it also allows that an impeached president who was removed would not be able to run for office again. And just to finish on a very cynical point, actually what people are saying here around Washington is that might be a reason why some Republicans might vote to remove Donald Trump. In other words, the Ted Cruzes of the world who fancy a run at the presidency themselves in 2024 might actually be quite keen to remove Donald Trump and vote to convict him of impeachment if it meant it gets Donald Trump out of the picture from running in 2024 and it leaves, you know, the path open for them.
Suzanne Lynch in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to a special live edition of The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. I'm joined now by Dr. Jeffrey Howard and Professor Cynthia Miller-Idris. Jeffrey Howard is an Associate Professor of Political Theory at UCL, and Cynthia Miller-Idris is Director of the Polarization and Extremism Research at the American University and author of Hate in the Homeland, The New Global Far Right. Jeffrey, I'll come to you first. What we're learning or what we're understanding about what happened on Wednesday is plenty bad. Bad enough, but is there a case that the United States actually got off quite lightly compared to what it could have been?
Oh, absolutely, Andrew. I mean, it's a relatively small number of deaths. Each death, of course, is a tragedy, but it's a relatively small number of deaths given what could have happened. We know that police discovered Molotov cocktails in a truck near the Capitol. We knew that there were pipe bombs under construction, and had one of these bombs been detonated, had a bomb been detonated in the chamber with politicians present, this could have been escalated very, very quickly, and we could be talking about assassinations. And then the talk of terrorism, which to some voices has seemed a bit hyperbolic or overblown, given the largely motley crew that assembled in the Capitol that day to raid it, would suddenly seem justified. Or imagine if someone in a foreign terrorist organization had somehow infiltrated the crowd and detonated a suicide vest. Imagine if someone, perhaps a Russian operative, had infiltrated the crowd and accessed intelligence. We saw that protester, that raider inside Nancy Pelosi's office accessing her emails. So I definitely think we got off lighter than it could have been.
Cynthia, what's your sense of how organized, premeditated the whole thing looked? There has, of course, been much made of those pictures of some of the rioters carrying plastic cuffs, possibly with a view to attempting to take hostages, and comparisons made to the apparent plot which unraveled a few months back to storm the state legislature in Michigan and take the governor prisoner. How cohesive an operation did it appear to be to you?
Absolutely, an important question. And I think it's one of the things that is confusing to observers is that what we had here was a real toxic mix of planned and spontaneous violence. So we have the planned violence that Jeffrey was just talking about with the pipe bombs and the Molotov cocktails and images of people with these flexi cuffs or plastic zip ties. With weapons, with mace, with, you know, all kinds of coming clearly prepared to mount a terrorist act or an insurrection that would be violent and that could cause death or physical harm to people. But it also is clear that there were additional kind of spontaneous mob action through rioters kind of getting swept up in the movement at that time to the Capitol, and then seeing you know, in a kind of mob way moving forward. And that's this kind of loose coalition that we see between all the imagery of people there who have, you know, white supremacist and neo-Nazi insignia and tattoos, militia kinds of insignia, Proud Boys, but also a whole range of QAnon supporters and the kind of Trump and MAGA super fans who are waving those flags. And so it's hard to say right now, and I know this is what law enforcement is investigating at the moment, which people within that, and all of those are criminal acts. I mean, they're all prosecutable and will be, you know, I think they'll be charged, but there is a difference in terms of the threat landscape moving forward between the kind of measure of planning that went into some of the plotting of the violence and those who are swept up more spontaneously in it.
Jeffrey, what we want to try and do with this episode is establish some sense of where this paranoia and mania that has been stoked up during the last 4 years goes without Trump. Is it your sense that it does have a life of its own, or is it so attached to the Donald Trump personality cult that without him as a rallying point, it might sort of fizzle?
I mean, the hope certainly is that it fizzles. Whether it does in practice, I think you're entirely right, is an open question. It seems to me too fanciful to think that it's only because of the singular charisma of this one bombastic figure, and without him, it entirely fizzles. Clearly, there's a deep sense of alienation, of disaffection among Trump supporters. Clearly, this sense of alienation and disaffection is deeply tied to their identity. And the sense that their country is being taken away from them, where I think it's entirely unjustified, this sense, I think is nevertheless palpable. It's real. And even without Donald Trump in office, I think clearly there are other politicians waiting in the wings and indeed coming out of the wings, as we saw the past couple of weeks, to take over that mantle. So certainly someone like Josh Hawley, from the senator from Missouri, who was instrumental in propagating the lie that the election of Joe Biden was fraudulent and that Congress should intervene to investigate and indeed stop it, has been a crucial figure in the last couple of weeks. And he is a much more polished figure than the president of the United States. And he's just one example. Ted Cruz is another, notwithstanding his recent remarks of skepticism toward the Capitol raiders themselves. So I think that we have to be very alert to the possibility that there are going to be other figures who are going to come out of the wings and try to lead this movement. And because I don't think it's going away. Oh, and by the way, notwithstanding his being banned from Twitter, Donald Trump, I think, will continue to assert himself as a leader of this movement, trying to direct its energy and foment and stoke the hatred that is so core to it.
Cynthia, paranoia is obviously nothing new in American politics and in American political culture. You don't require a necessarily long memory to be able to recall such specters as Senator Joseph McCarthy or the John Birch Society or any one of dozens of others. But that notwithstanding, does what we're witnessing now strike you as something new? Because it's no longer a question, is it, of people merely harbouring a few eccentric beliefs, even if those eccentric beliefs went up to and including believing that Dwight Eisenhower was some sort of Soviet agent. We're talking about large numbers of Americans inhabiting an entirely invented imaginary universe.
Exactly. I think, I mean, what we're talking about here is fringe conspiracies conspiratorial beliefs having moved from the fringes into the mainstream, where we now have tens of millions of people who fervently believe in rampant disinformation about an election being stolen from them, about mass voter fraud, about completely untrue and false claims about the democratic process. So much so, and this is where I think that while these charismatic leaders matter, it's the conspiracy itself is so deeply embedded now and so much part of things like QAnon, which have rapidly grown specifically under the pandemic conditions as well, that I think now the genie is out of the bottle in terms of the disinformation ecosystem and whether we can move forward even under a new administration to win these people kind of back into believing in the democratic process or believing in fact and science. And so I think that's the bigger issue is of course we are going to continue to have people who amplify it, and I absolutely agree with Jeff in really dangerous ways. But I think these people are already fervent believers of an alternative universe of about the democratic system that is incredibly damaging and dangerous, and we'll be living with that for years to come.
Just to follow that up quickly, Cynthia, if we look at this as kind of an apex moment for this movement, is there any possibility that an encounter with reality in the form of the fairly hefty prison sentences, which now look on the way for some of the rioters who've already been identified and arrested, does that let some of the air out of it if all but the hardcore start to realize that we have passed the point at which this was all fun and games?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I would expect to happen, and I, I agree that it's difficult to predict, but what I would expect to happen is a little bit of a split response that we certainly have groups across the far right spectrum who have been celebrating since Wednesday, who see this as a tremendous success, who are extraordinarily proud of their accomplishment at getting into the Capitol, at doing what 4 months ago, far-right groups in the storming of the German parliament failed to do. I mean, they see this as a categorical success, as something that will go down in history as a key moment for these movements. And so those groups will continue to not only be validated by what's happened, but frame those who are going to prison and who have died as martyrs. And that's already happening in the online ecosystem. For the more kind of spontaneous mob action caught up by MAGA fans and some of the QAnon supporters, I think there is a hope that this will be a sobering moment, that they maybe weren't fully thinking through some of these consequences, but I think their beliefs are still going to be very strong. It's, you know, you can be radicalized, but not yet mobilized. And I think what we were seeing here was, you know, we moved from polarization to radicalization, where people had this extraordinarily strong us versus them sentiment and believed in an existential threat. And then what we had was mass mobilization in terms of thousands of people being willing to undertake political violence. And that's a turning point in kind of challenges to democracy and public safety. And I think if people walk back from some of the mobilization, that's a good thing. We'll see less violence from sort of more ordinary citizens who are not normally card-carrying members of fringe groups. But I think we still face the danger of them being radicalized and believing in this alternative ecosystem, potentially being able to be mobilized again toward violence if they feel threatened or feel that they have, you know, had something stolen, an election stolen, and because they really truly believe they are defending democracy. And that's why you see this language around, they keep using the language around freedom and things have been stolen from them, and that this is democracy under threat. So if they truly believe that they are the defenders of democracy, that's a very difficult thing to kind of walk back.
Jeffrey, how worried are you that the rot may have spread further or perhaps higher? And by that I mean, does what happened on Wednesday lend a certain baleful meaning to that letter that was signed a few days beforehand by 10, I think, former secretaries of defense, warning whoever cared to read it that there was no place for the US military in helping to determine who had or had not won an election?
Well, I think we're going to learn more in the coming days about, for example, why the National Guard took so long to help quell the riots at the Capitol. To what extent did the purge of DOD officials by the Trump administration earlier this month play some role in the reticence of the National Guard to get involved, the reticence of other aspects of the federal government to get involved during the Capitol raid? I myself am somewhat more optimistic. I was struck by this YouGov poll earlier this week suggesting that 45% of registered Republicans who'd heard of the Capitol incident approved of it. Now, a lot of people are alarmed by that poll. Gosh, 45% of registered Republicans who'd heard of the incident thought that storming the Capitol was something that they approved of. But I think I look at the other number there and I say, well, actually, that indicates that there's a real fissure within the Republican Party, within people who supported Trump. And up until now, we've been struck by just how much the Republican Party, basically as a whole, with a few exceptions, have been willing to go along with the Trump agenda. And I think now, is it a turning point? I certainly hope that it is. And we certainly have some evidence that it will be, because it seems that a huge proportion of the Republican Party doesn't approve of what happened. And it is becoming much easier for people who were really diehard loyalists to Trump up until now, people like outgoing Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, to really turn on him in a quite staggering way that we couldn't have predicted. And I certainly, this bodes well for Trumpism being marginalized within the Republican Party and a more rational, traditional Romney-like GOP reasserting itself in the coming year.
Cynthia, for all that it's probably very difficult to generalize about the clearly tens of millions of people who believe some or all of this paranoid conspiratorial universe that we're discussing, have you been able to reach any conclusions about who they are in the main? Because it has been pointed out before that there does appear to be certain trends towards middle-aged white people, and not necessarily poor middle-aged white people. There have been already identified among the mobs in the Capitol, you know, perfectly educated professionals, some indeed with quite distinguished service histories in the police or military. And there's also the fact that there seem to be more women subscribing to this one than is usual for movements rooted in nationalist paranoia.
Right. The demographic questions here are really interesting. And so part of what we see across the far right spectrum generally is that the economic issue that plays a role is a sense of precarity. So it's not actual economic, it's not really being poor, but it's a sense that something's being taken from you or that you're more vulnerable. And that's that sense of insecurity and precarity that is a predictor of far-right engagement. That's been true for some time across the spectrum. And we're just seeing in a moment when there's a lot of economic precarity, you could see that could potentially play a role. But that's also a white grievance, a sense that something's being taken from you. And so we see that in the white supremacist extremist fringe as well, that there's this sense of existential threat because of demographic change or immigration. And so it's that, again, that precarity and insecurity that tends to play a bigger role than actual than actually being disadvantaged economically compared to others. On the issue of gender, this is a really fascinating point, and I'm really glad you brought it up, because it hasn't been talked a lot about in terms of what we saw Wednesday. We we have been seeing more conversation about these intersections between things like misogyny or toxic masculinity and in things like the Michigan plot, for example, where the language in that in their communication about the governor was incredibly misogynistic and about the growing overlaps between things like the Proud Boys, right, where you have these men's groups, men's only groups, and other groups that are really clearly kind of incel related or violence against women as it relates to the far right spectrum. But we haven't had as much conversation about the growing role of women in these movements. And I think what we saw in the images, and including the fact that a woman was killed inside the Capitol, what we saw were still overwhelmingly movements of men, but far more women showing up in these photos and the images, having been maced, having been inside the Capitol. And that's really a reflection of, in large part, a reflection of more women being involved in QAnon. QAnon has attracted more middle-aged women, middle-aged moms, who are also pushing back in these anti-mask kinds of ways, sometimes coming out of wellness communities. I mean, really unusual places where you think, some of the yoga communities pushing a lot of, alternative medicine, not believing in the vaccine, part of the kind of conspiracies. And so we have seen more women be recruited into QAnon and these kinds of deep conspiracies, which then have deep overlaps with the ideas about election interference and this universe of parallel universe of beliefs.
Jeffrey, a refrain we have heard many times since Wednesday by politicians and pundits alike is that this is not us. This is not America. This is not how we do things here. I mean, as anybody who has broached an American history book will be aware, that is total nonsense. The United States has a long and quite impressive history of political violence and populist demagogues. But nonetheless, do you think that this is something entirely new? Is it more useful to think of this not in terms of America's history of political extremism, but within America's history or facility for inventing its own religions?
Well, I think it is tempting, and I do see it as part of an old struggle. It's tempting to see it as this, and I think this temptation should be indulged, that there is this struggle between the forces of exclusion and darkness on the one hand, and the forces of inclusion and light, if you will, on the other hand. And I think at its core, that is what's going on here. And it isn't really a claim about the American experience. It's a claim about the human experience, that there are these deep tendencies to be exclusionary, to lash out at those we don't understand, those we have deemed an other, to find a kind of in-group or tribe and stand with it against those that we disagree with, and to ignore evidence that contradicts whatever confirms our identity. And then there's this other part of us that's more hopeful, and that is more cooperative, and that there is this deep tension in human nature, and that we're seeing play it out. So at its core, I don't think it's anything new. What's different is the context, and the way that social media in particular enables people to connect with one another who wouldn't previously have been able to find each other so easily. The way social media amplifies certain voices for better, of course, as we saw with the Me Too movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, but also for worse, as we see with QAnon. So I think it's not so much that the core phenomenon is any different, it's that the context in which it's taking place has changed technologically that allows the problem to be bigger than it would have been in an earlier era.
Which, Cynthia, brings us finally to the question of what one does about combating all this within that context that Jeffrey delineates. I mean, obviously, social media is not necessary to the fomentation of paranoid fantasies. The John Birch Society used to make do perfectly well with a mimeographed newsletter sent through the post, but it does make it a great deal easier. And the question is thrown into starker relief, of course, by Twitter punting Donald Trump off their platform. Is there a way that this disinformation ecosystem can be combated, especially in a discourse which is protected by the First Amendment?
The issue about how to combat and prevent and interrupt kind of radicalization and extremist ideas in general, is the evidence on this shows that The easiest way to do it, of course, is to prevent them from happening to begin with. And so the prevention and intervention ecosystem has to be built out in much greater depth in the U.S. in ways that just that we've never made investments in, to help people understand, for example, just some basic media literacy on a large scale with the public. What does propaganda look like? How does persuasive extremist rhetoric work? Why is it, why are scapegoating techniques kind of so popular? And how, you know, and so we have done a really great job of teaching fifth graders over the last decade, you know, how to recognize predators online and how to protect their digital privacy. But they get no information in their digital communications classes about what propaganda is or what extremist content might look like if they encounter it. And so we know that just like awareness of grooming is growing, that you know, this awareness of that, of how to protect children and young people, but even adults from kind of online radicalization is critical. But once people are already radicalized, the evidence on that is especially for conspiracy theories, is that it's extremely difficult to initiate kind of de-radicalization. And the best way for conspiracy theories is really through loved ones, through empathy, through kind of non-judgmental interaction, keeping a trusted line of communication open. It's extremely difficult to do that just by shutting down the information, because people will believe that's part of the conspiracy and the plot. It will just reinforce. And so I'm not saying it's not important to ban that content. It is, but it doesn't actually help de-radicalize based on all the evidence we know.
Cynthia Miller Idris and Jeffrey Howard, thank you both very much for joining us on The Foreign Desk. And that is it for this special live edition of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.